The day after September the 11th, I was invited on ABC television in America, and the first question was, where was God when the tower fell? A little later, I was on National Public Radio, their equivalent of the BBC, and the first question was, I saw a woman running through the smoke crying out, God, where are you? What should I have said to her? Both of them apologized to me afterwards for such a soundbite question, which was impossible to answer. But they said they had to. If you think evil is the greatest mystery we have in our human lives, time is a mystery, an explanation of our human consciousness is a mystery, but neither of those are anywhere near the magnitude of the challenge of the mystery of evil. It is the greatest mystery we face in life. But if you think too, it is also the greatest challenge of our modern world. We have just finished the most murderous century in human history, Europe's most evil century. And so we really have to face up to this challenge for ourselves. Now, what I've tried to do every day is move along in terms of a thinking person's quest for meaning, and then pick up one issue each day that fits in with that. Now, what you say, why on earth does evil fit in with a thinker's quest for meaning? Well, it's often the case that as people are thinking through that search for meaning, they get to the point they have questions, they can see the adequacy of faith, they can really explore that it's true, and they're very close to being attracted by it, but suddenly objections come in. Well, wait a minute, what about... And in my own experience, the two greatest objections that come in at that late stage, the first, and we haven't time for this in this series, is hypocrisy. Surely there's a great deal of hypocrisy in the church, in religion, in individuals you may know, or whatever. And that's a very serious question. And in many ways, that's one of the great hard-to-answer questions about the faith, hypocrisy. Except Jesus has the deepest anti-hypocrisy course in all history. And it was Jesus, actually, who gave the morally charged understanding of hypocrisy. But the far deeper question that comes up at the end, or maybe earlier still, is evil. How can God allow? But if you're thinking today, one of the questions the 20th century raised, and it's quite different from earlier centuries, what does it say of us as human beings that it was our species that did all these things? And as you know, there's a famous exchange in Auschwitz. Where is God? One prisoner said. And the other said to him very simply, where is man? In other words, evil as we see it today does raise great questions about God. In fact, our atheist friends call the problem of evil the rock of atheism. But in fact, evil raises just as many questions about our humanity. Now, my own approach, and I believe that no one has the last word on this. No one. Many people have written on it. Many people have wrestled with it. Obviously, our answers are satisfying to us, but not to everyone. There is no universally acceptable answer to the great challenge of evil. So I'm giving you my own approach. Now, you'll understand as we go into this, I happen to be born in the middle of World War II in the Japanese invasion, where 17 million died. We lived a little afterwards in Nanking, which had just experienced the horrendous rape of Nanking, the most brutal savagery of all the 20th century massacres. And as Mark said, I remember as a 9-year-old, the beginning of the Reign of Terror following the success of the Chinese Revolution, and we were living in the capital city where the Reign of Terror took place and the public executions took place. And I remember friends I'd known just a week earlier, they just walked by you without acknowledging you, because simply to acknowledge a Westerner was probably enough to seal their death sentence. So from the very earliest age, I was brought up to look evil in the white of the eye. And my own parents gave me the challenge of understanding evil and coming to grapple with it. It wasn't just a recent thing in my case. My own way of tackling this is to start with all of us as human beings and say, what are the questions and the steps we have to think through? Now, in Mark's meager minutes, as I call his 20 minutes every day, I can't possibly deal with this huge question in any great depth. But let me just mention some of the steps so that you can think them through to yourself, and then I want to focus just on one of them with greater expansion. The first step, I think, thinking it through, is to recognize the sources of evil and suffering. Evil is active. Suffering is passive. Evil is the intent to do harm. That's why I'm talking more about evil than suffering, but they are closely linked. Nobody knows where it ultimately entered the universe. Jews and Christians believe that we're told how it enters planet Earth. But what we all know is how it enters our lives approximately. Three ways. Through our bodies, through nature, or through our fellow human beings. And you need to think through all of those. As that wonderful song yesterday, Fragile. When Winston Churchill was nearly killed when he stepped out in the road in Manhattan in the early 1930s, and he was hit by a speeding car, imagine what World War II would have been without him, he said, I don't know why I wasn't crushed like a gooseberry and broken like an eggshell. We've just seen the Olympics. Incredible human bodies. Speed, strength, magnificent. But all sorts of genetic dysfunctions can hit us before we're born. 1,000 diseases while we're alive. And all sorts of things will end our lives, including things like dementia. And these little power packs of ours are very fragile. Nature. I mentioned China. I was too young to remember, but in that time, we were in a place where we had the Japanese army on one side, the communist army on the other side, and the nationalist army below us. And there was a terrible famine. They recurred frequently in China in those days. Many people dated their lives by the famines. But in this particular famine, 5 million died in 3 months, including my two brothers. I nearly died. My mother nearly died. My mother was a surgeon. She said she could have been a ballet dancer, a stockbroker, for all the use she was in a famine, without any food and without any medicine. And if you only watch recent tsunamis, or you've been in an earthquake or a hurricane or a tornado or whatever, you realize that the forces of nature in front of them, we're very vulnerable. But of course, the greatest source of evil and suffering is our fellow human beings. G.K. Chesterton, I mentioned, he says, we talk of wild animals, he said, but we are the wildest of them all. What do you make of the fact that in the last century, 100 million killed in war, another 100 million under political repression, and yet another 100 million in ethnic and sectarian violence. Nearly 1/3 of a billion human beings killed by their fellow human beings. That's us. Now that first step, and you've got to think through much greater depth, recognizing the sources, it at least should leave us first with a deep realism. This is our world. Any of us may suffer, and all of us will die. And the examined life demands that we think of what evil is in the face of reality. Hopefully, too, we go beyond realism to compassion. The second step, deeper, would be to listen to the questions. Suffering hits people uniquely, and no sufferer is like any other, and certainly we shouldn't categorize people. But if you listen to people who are suffering, whatever the cause is, questions and deep responses are pressed instinctively out of the human heart and the human mind, and you can boil them down to variations of three. One, why me? 2, where's God? And 3, how can I stand it? Why me? Again, we haven't got time to look into examples, but many people are suddenly hit by a thing. The whole universe moves from terra firma to a sense of nervousness and randomness and so on. Why me? Why not me? And it never quite leaves you. I often ask why I lived and my brothers died. Solzhenitsyn, he lived and millions died around him in the gulag. You have stories, say, of soldiers in war. 3 of them go with the brow of the hill and 2 are immediately shot dead. The 3rd one survives unscathed, except for a lifetime of nightmares that oppress him. Why on earth did he live and not them? Why me? The 2nd question is an obvious one. When evil hits people, it's often so unjust and so irrational that it cries out for an answer. Someone must carry the can for the injustice. Someone must provide the answer for the irrationality. And obviously you think back and back and back and back. Who else can you blame but God, if there is a God? And as you know, it's not funny. Many atheists in the moment of pain cry out against a God in whom they don't believe. Stendhal, if there's a God, he's the devil. That's Baudelaire. Stendhal, the only excuse for God, he doesn't exist. But at a moment of pain, many an atheist has cried out to a God in whom they don't believe. But of course, it's a cry of faith too. And we as followers of Christ, who we are, you know, the greatest of them all was our Lord himself. My God, why have you forsaken me? The 3rd question, how can I stand it, is and sounds the most practical. And when people are in terrible pain or just tortured by some evil or whatever it is, they want to hang on to get through the day, to survive the night and so on. And it's simple, what I call fridge truths, that allow people to hang on like that. How can I stand it? But if you think, that's actually the question that's also the most philosophical. Camus rightly says, the ultimate philosophical question is suicide. He's not being depressing. What he means is, when everything is despairing around you and everything seems meaninglessness, what is it that allows you to stand it and keep going? It's your understanding of what's the real reason to live. If you don't have it, you're in trouble. You may have read Primo Levi, one of the great survivors of Auschwitz, an Italian Jewish scientist. At one point in Auschwitz, he was desperately thirsty, and there was a huge icicle outside his camp, outside the hut. He reached out for it, thinking of it like a cold free drink. And the guards, seeing him, smashed the icicle into the mud. And instinctively, Levi cried out, "Why?" And the guard said coldly, "Here, there is no why." And that weighed on Levi. He survived, along with Elie Wiesel and others. He survived for 47 years. His passion was to witness that it might never happen again, never again. 47 years later, he came to the point where he realized he had no why, and he took his own life. And what's sobering is that if you look at the intellectual atheists in Auschwitz, Jean Emery, Bruno Bettelheim, Primo Levi, and many, many others, those who couldn't stand it were more of them atheist intellectuals than any other group of people. They had no why, and they couldn't stand it. Think it through. The 3rd step to think through is to appreciate the modern transformations of evil. If we look at the last century, I don't think we're more evil as human beings than previous centuries, but I do think modernity has transformed evil in all sorts of powerful ways we need to recognize very clearly. I haven't time to go into that one in depth. For a start, there's a plus in the modern world. The modern world minimizes pain, which is wonderful. Simple things like the rise of anesthetics or the aspirin. We live today, as it said, more people can live their adult lives without any pain than any generation ever in history. And that's good, of course, except it's one of the reasons we're unrealistic about evil. Many people have never seen death or real suffering, except for gratuitous sort of television violence and so on, which makes it even more unreal. But that's a good thing, the minimizing of pain. But on the whole, modernity has amplified our destructiveness. Not in the sense of our weaponry. Thank God the monsters of the last century, or this one, have not had, say, nuclear weaponry. If they had, the world would have been in a terrible place. Only one nation has used it. But modernity amplifies destructiveness in other ways. Our managerial methods, our division of labor, our diffusion of responsibility. So Auschwitz went forward with all the genius that the German manufacturing went forward in the 1930s, and the German chemical factors went forward. And there's a deep link between modernity and the Holocaust and all sorts of other forms of modern killing, which we've got to grapple with very seriously as a generation. But let me move on to the fourth step, which is the one I really want to focus on today. Coming to grips with evil, we have to assess the different interpretations and perspectives. In other words, we confront it. It's reality, and we want to be realistic. But then how do we understand it, and then how do we respond to it? Sadly, we haven't got time for the responses. But in terms of this series, the understanding and the assessment is a very, very crucial part. And here's a clear place where what I described earlier is the three families of faiths each have a distinctively different understanding of evil. And you've got to think through which you think, in terms of Tuesday discussion, is the most adequate, and then also true, and gives you a basis to respond to evil with courage and the appropriate action. Now, of course, anything I say in 2 minutes on each of these is trivial. But even if I could say a lot more, what matters is not what I say, it's what each of you think, having explored and come to your own conclusion. So don't take my word for it. But take the Eastern religions. Having lived a good many of my years in the East, studied Buddhism, studied under a guru, as I said the other day, personally, I would give both Hinduism and Buddhism high marks for the diagnosis. Hinduism and Buddhism see what they call as dukkha, or affliction, at the very center of life. They are realistic. Many Western people are really Pollyannas. They have never, ever looked at evil and death in the white of the eye. The Eastern religions do. You could even say Buddhism is a religion-sized answer to the problem of evil. It was when Gautama Buddha saw the sick man, the old man, and the dead man, and so on, in his journey, that he set off as a seeker to answer the problem of what affliction and dukkha was in life. But, you know, in the Eastern system, we're in the wheel. We have desire, which leads to craving, which leads to attachment, which binds us to the wheel. And the problem is not that we die. The problem is we're reborn. And unlike the Californian groovy man groovy about reincarnation, in the East it's a matter of weary fatalistic resignation. Hindus say you go around on average 35,000 times. And the goal, of course, is to get off the wheel. And moksha, freedom, is freedom from being caught on the wheel in this life in the world of illusion or maya. So you can see that you have no vision of a world of freedom from suffering, freedom from evil, freedom from injustice as a vision of where they're going. Rather, freedom from this world altogether. Let me give you an example that's just moved many people. If you love haiku poetry, you may know the name Isa, 18th century poet. He had five children and a wife whom he adored. And one after the other, each of his five children and his wife died. And every time one did, he went to the Zen master and he said, "Why?" And the master gave him the same advice every time, which was, "Remember, the world is dew, D-W. Dew is transient, sun rises, melts away. That's this world, it's all an illusion, impermanent. And we're not to be attached to this world, we're to renounce and get beyond this world by whatever method, yoga, right mindfulness, or whatever. Remember, the world is dew." One time Isa went home, I can't remember which of his children died, but he went home and wrote one of his most famous haiku poems, you know, 17 syllables, and transliterated into English, it runs like this. "The world is dew, the world is dew, and yet, the whole logic of Buddhism in the first two lines. But the logic of a father, or it may have been a husband's heart, in the last two lines. And yet, are we satisfied that by that? That it's all impermanence and illusion and unreality? No, it just cries out into the darkness." But don't take my word for it. You read Siddhartha and the Buddhists and other things like that and explore it for yourself and see if you find that a truly adequate answer to evil in our world. Well, how about the secularist family? Many of them don't tackle it. Where is Richard Dawkins' book on evil? Now, we have had great atheists who tackled it. Bertrand Russell. We're the product of a chance collocation of atoms, and we're moving towards a common doom. And on this little journey of life, and so on and so on and so on, he doesn't really have any answer. And if you've read A Free Man's Worship, he later said, the good news that I thought it was, he even called it his gospel, he said it didn't stand the test of reality and real life. But there's no real answer in A Free Man's Worship. There's no hope that the world will be any better, because the fight is forlorn. And you get the same thing in the far more passionate and far more moving book by Albert Camus. You may have read The Plague. And you remember in The Plague, which is Camus' metaphor for evil in the world, the plague in Iran. Dr. Rieu, who's his hero, cannot bear to see a human die. Magnificent heroism. So as a doctor, he fights for it. Person after person after person he treats. But one night after he's buried one of his friends, he says, "I know, we're facing never-ending defeat." Now what is it that underlies? Well, if you go back to someone like Schopenhauer, the great German atheist, Schopenhauer says the problem is existence itself is the error. Or as Beckett said following him, Samuel Beckett, the sin is the sin of being born. Existence is the error. The world is just plain evil. And since it's natural to the world, what you're facing is never-ending defeat. Camus' picture, of course, was Sisyphus. Rolling that stone up the hill, rolls down again. Rolling it up, rolls down again. Rolling it up, rolls down again. Never-ending defeat. I rebel, therefore I exist. But at the end of the day, forlorn. Again, incredible courage. I often used to look at Bertrand Russell, and you looked at the profile of his face. He would admit to us as students, at that stage when he was in his early 90s, he was reading two novels a week, he said, to keep his mind off the horror of the nuclear destruction of the world. He was leading the CND campaign at that time. He couldn't bear it because of the meaninglessness it introduced into his philosophy. Diversion, two novels a week. Why? Existence itself is the error. Well, how do you change that? Well, where is the Jewish and Christian worldviews different? You can say a lot here, too, and obviously what I'm saying is brief and simplistic. But let me put it like this. The greatest challenge thrown against the Christian faith is what's called the trilemma. Is evil really evil? Is God really good? And is God really powerful? Do you believe all three of those? How can you in the light of evil? Actually, the Bible teaches each of those three, but gives each of them a distinctive twist, which makes it a reassurance rather than a trilemma. I haven't time to expand on each of the three. And tonight, Richard will actually be talking about the second of the three, so I'll leave that one. But let me just mention the first and the third. Is evil really evil? No one can look at our world and deny that. But what the Bible says, evil is evil, but it should have been otherwise. It wasn't supposed to be this way. It wasn't always this way. One day it will not be this way. And here and now, when we feel the shock, the outrage, the grief, we're actually experiencing the disjointedness of a universe which should have been otherwise. George Steiner, the Jewish writer, he says, you can't look, say, at an animal being mistreated or a child being abused or something just outrageous without feeling there's a broken covenant here. Something is terribly out of joint. You see the difference from the atheist? Not existence is the error. Existence in the Jewish and Christian view was good. God made a world that was good, very good. But through the sin and the fall and disobedience, the disjointedness has come in. So evil is not natural. It's a party pooper. I understood this in a living way for myself many years ago when I was with Francis Schaeffer, who many of you know, and his distinguished son-in-law with us today. We heard in Switzerland of an eminent Christian leader from America who had lost his son in a cycling accident. And he preached in Paris at the funeral, and everyone said he preached with hope and all sorts of good things and magnificent. And Francis Schaeffer heard this and he said, I hope he felt the same thing inside. Didn't say any more. 3 weeks later, we heard this man wanted to speak to Schaeffer. And he came, and I remember introducing them. 5 minutes later, you know the walls of a Swiss chalet are wooden, often very thin, and if a voice is raised, you can easily hear. We left. You could hear this, quote, eminent Christian leader cursing God and blaspheming. Why did God take his son? And so on. Later, I asked Francis Schaeffer what sort of approach he'd take. He said, I took him to John chapter 11. The story of Jesus at the tomb of his good friend Lazarus. Famous because it says in English, the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. But three times it says, much stronger in the Greek than the English, Jesus was furious. The word used is, the word Aeschylus uses, are war horses about to charge into battle, snorting through the strongest Greek word you can have on anger. And that's the word used of Jesus. Why was he angry? He'd made a good world. But he'd entered his father's world and brokenness and ruin is all around him. And it's summarized in the death of his good friend, dying prematurely. He didn't accept it, thank God. No, he was angry. It was wrong. It's unnatural. It's a gatecrasher. And that's the Christian view. Evil is evil, but it should have been otherwise, and one day it will be otherwise. The second part of the trilemma, is God all good? And in the sentence, I would say the answer to that is, no other God has wounds. He cares, he comes, he suffers. But that's Richard's topic tonight. Come back tonight. Let me pick up the third. Is God all powerful? Because this raises the question, if I don't know what God is doing, and it doesn't look as if he's all powerful, how can I trust him? In the 1950s, that was the challenge thrown against Christians by the philosophy department at Oxford, which was full of atheists in those days, A.J. Eyre, J.L. Mackey, and so on. The answer to that was given by a man who was later my tutor, Basil Mitchell, the famous parable of the resistance fighter. Sort of runs like this. Say, this is World War II, and Mark comes to me and he says, I gather you're the local resistance leader. I want to sign on. and we have a couple of hours together in the pub. I say to him, all right, ask me any question you like. We'll be together face to face for 2 hours. But if you sign on after tonight, we'll never be together again. It's too dangerous. You just have to trust. What I'm doing may be obvious. I'm rescuing other resistance fighters. What I'm doing may not be obvious. I'm arresting our resistance fighters in Gestapo uniform. You won't know that I'm putting on as disguise, and round the corner I'm releasing them. Until after the war, when the codes are broken and everything's revealed, you'll realize quite what's happening. And Basil Mitchell said that's exactly Christian trust in God in enemy territory. The two deepest questions to bring to God is he there, his existence? Is he good, his character? And both of those are actually answered fully, finally, in Jesus. So we know why we trust the resistance leader, even if we can't see quite what he's doing. We're in the dark about X, Y, and Z. I don't know why Auschwitz. I don't know why my wife had cancer. But I'm not in the dark about God. And so we can trust him with understanding about him, even if we don't understand everything in the world. The resistance leader knows what he's doing. And even J.L. Mackey admitted that parable answered the philosophical questions raised. Let me bring this to conclusion. The toughest objection to faith was the one raised by Adorno in the last century from the Frankfurt School. After Auschwitz, there cannot be a God. Adorno also said, after Auschwitz, there cannot be love. After Auschwitz, there cannot be poetry and beauty. In other words, all that is great in our humanness is called into question by the malignant malevolence of what we saw at Auschwitz, evil at its worst. What's the answer to that? Actually, Viktor Frankl gave the answer as a Jewish believer who'd been through Auschwitz, and he said this. First, those who say that were not in Auschwitz. In Auschwitz, Frankl said, and he was there, more people deepened their faith or discovered faith for the first time. And as I said, it was the atheist intellectuals who couldn't stand it and committed suicide. And Frankl gave this wonderful little picture, which I've loved ever since. He said, if you have a little fire, a little breeze can easily blow it out. And that is inadequate faith, inadequate faith. He said, if you have a big fire, what happens when a strong wind hits it? It fans it into an even stronger fire. And I remember reading that and thinking of my own mother, whom I adored, and she often said that it was in Nanking in the 1940s and earlier in that terrible famine with 5 million dying all around her, including my brothers. It was in the heart of the worst evil she'd ever seen that her faith in God became unshakably real. Is evil the rock of atheism? I think atheism has one of the weakest answers to evil you have today. I would say there's no simple answers to the problem of evil and suffering, but there is nothing like the profundity of the Christian answer to evil.